Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
Oh, I am back. It's been a long time since I've had a chance to speak with you all, a long time since you all been able to hear me. The longest break I have taken from the podcast, but the break is over. Back to work, back to explaining and defending the faith here on the Council of Trent podcast, which I am now recording here, giving it my best shot on video. Hopefully we'll upload it to YouTube soon. I know I have made that promise before and we have had technical difficulties, but I am staring right into the eyes of my Logitech camera and it is glowing right back at me. So I think things are going well, playing around here with my Camtasia software. Very excited to give all this a try and to be able to really spruce up the show here for 2019. One of my many resolutions, but it will not go the way of resolutions like trying to exercise. For myself, actually, I do want to get in shape for 2019. That is something I have been meaning to do. I don't want to have dad bod. You have to understand, being married, having children, it does a number on you, even physically. I mean, we fathers, we husbands, we give up our very bodies for the vocation of marriage. I mean, wives, mothers, how could you ever understand? Of course, I am being facetious, aka just kidding. You all make far more sacrifices in every corner of life than we do. And for that, we husbands and fathers are eternally grateful. For those of you who are joining us, of course, here in the new year, but weren't present that much here in the previous year, let me introduce myself. I am Trent Horn, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker. And this is the Council of Trent podcast, where we explain and defend the Catholic faith, talk about what's going on in the world today, and how we should look at it from a Catholic perspective. So I want to thank you guys for being here. I also want to thank our premium subscribers, those of you who have supported the podcast. I got a chance to meet a few of you at SEEK. This past week, I was at the biannual SEEK conference that was put on by the Fellowship of Catholic University Students. It was an amazing event. There were, I think, 17,000 people at this conference. It was a huge conference to be at. And I was very blessed to have been invited to go and speak at it. I was given a workshop, you know, one of the breakout sessions. And normally when you give a breakout session at a conference, there's going to be, you know, maybe a few dozen, a few hundred people at your breakout. And one of my breakouts there were only a few hundred people there, which makes sense. I was up against, I think, Scott Hahn and a talk on dating, which everyone wants to hear about, and Father Mike Schmitz, who I affectionately call Father Cheekbones because he has almost superhuman cheekbones and are wonderful. God has blessed him with so many talents, both wisdom, the ability to preach, and pretty fine-looking guy, I will say right there. But in my first workshop, I had something like 1,000, 1,500, might have been 2,000 people. It was in Hall D at the Indianapolis Convention Center, and I was speaking on faith and science. And I was really happy to meet so many people who listen to the podcast or who subscribe to it, and also who promote it and support the podcast as a premium subscriber at trenthornpodcast.com. So if you want to help the podcast to grow, help us work out all the kinks in our video production we're doing right now, go ahead and check out trenthornpodcast.com. For as little as $10 a month, you get access to bonus content. Well, $5 a month, you get bonus content. $10, you get a nifty t-shirt with my mug upon it. Now, let's get down to business. Or as they say in Mulan, let's get down to business to defeat the Hun. I sang that. I was at a karaoke party once, and I didn't really know what to sing, so I scrolled through, and there it was, because I played this song over and over again for my children. So maybe for a special bonus content for our subscribers, I'll belt out a little bit more of that. Two news stories caught my attention over the Christmas break that I wanted to talk with you all about to help us better explain our faith, especially our commitment to defending human life. One of them was a challenge in Indiana law signed in by then Governor Mike Pence that the Supreme Court right now, I think they voted on it on this last Friday, so just a few days ago, whether they were going to take up this law. Here's what's reported in the LA Times. The Supreme Court on Friday weighed whether to hear a case involving the landmark Roe versus Wade decision. The first direct challenge to abortion rights the court has faced since Justice Brett M. Kavanaugh took his seat. The case involves an appeal from Indiana, which seeks to enforce a state law that forbids abortions by women who cite Down syndrome or the sex or race of the fetus as a reason for ending a pregnancy. Justices review the matter privately Friday, but were not expected to announce whether they will take the case until next week at the earliest. When Justice Anthony Kennedy was on the court, state lawyers did not seek to challenge Roe v. Wade, since Kennedy voted to uphold abortion rights decades before. But Kavanaugh, who replaced Kennedy on the court, has been seen as more conservative or open to limiting or overturning the right to abortion. So the article goes on to say that the state of Indiana wasted no time. They wanted to file an appeal so that this law could be heard at the Supreme Court. It was struck down at the circuit court, so there wasn't agreement there, about laws that prevent people from choosing abortion if the reason they do so is for a eugenic purpose. You could say this law, that from a broader sphere, you could say, shouldn't we do something about eugenics? The idea of wiping out entire groups of people because we determine that their lives are not as valuable as our lives, because they function differently than us, behave differently than us, have a different IQ or different set of physical abilities than us, then for some reason people erroneously claim that they're less valuable than we are. And this of course, is a natural consequence of a secular worldview. Because if you think about a secular worldview, they talk about human equality all the time. We should treat all humans as being equal. But here's the problem. What makes us equal? If you're going to treat people equally, you have to find what's equal about them before you say you're going to grant them equality. So for some people say, well, it's just the fact of being a member of the human species. Well, I would say that is definitely a very important marker, which means the unborn would be included right within that. But for a lot of people, you take Peter Singer, the Princeton bioethicist. He'll say that's speciesist. You know, it's that doesn't count because the human species is no better, really, than any other species. So to pride one species over any other is not a fair thing to do. It's a kind of discrimination, like racism. He calls it speciesism. I remember I actually met Peter Singer, it must have been about 11 years ago. I was at Arizona State University, and I got to have a private Q&A session with him and 100 other students. And I put the speciesist claim to the test, and I asked him if it was okay to euthanize a dog. My parents euthanized our dog because he was incontinent. And he was like, oh, maybe. And then he said, yeah, sure, I guess, if it was a big burden. So I said, okay, could you euthanize a five-year-old because they're incontinent and they're mentally handicapped? And he said, well, yeah, basically. Maybe not a five-year-old, but I think I picked something like a six-month-old infant. You know, of course, incontinent. They're just little pooping machines. Father of two, I would know that. And he said, yeah, you couldn't treat a six-month-old infant as being morally different than a dog or a cat because they're equally conscious, aware of the world around them. That's what you get from the secular worldview. So on the one hand, that's the logical outcome, but most people are committed to a Christian worldview, to a Christian worldview that says, no, all human beings are valuable regardless of their abilities, regardless of how developed they are, their race, religion. We should treat all human beings as being equal. But that if you ground that equality in being a member of the human species, then you've got to answer another argument, which is, why does the human species matter? And as a Christian, I think we've got a great answer for that. God, who is the source of all value, has created human beings in his image. That is why we're bearers of the ultimate source of value in the universe. So the Christian worldview makes sense of things like human equality, where the secular worldview, it really doesn't. So going on here in the LA Times interview, says that a federal judge blocked the Indiana law to prevent abortions for people in case of Down syndrome from taking effect in 2016. Seventh Circuit Court in Chicago declared the law unconstitutional, and the judges said that, you know, this is between a woman and her doctor. You can't intervene. But in June, two of President Trump's new appointees, including Judge Amy Coney Barrett, which I would really enjoy seeing on the Supreme Court in some case. Mr. President, if you're watching, consider Amy Coney Barrett. I think she's got the right chops for this. I'm just saying. She joined a dissenting opinion that urged the appeals court to reconsider its ruling. Judge Frank Easterbrook said the Supreme Court had not directly ruled on a eugenic statute like the Indiana law. This is not a law that's trying to ban abortion outright. In fact, you could say it's not even a law about abortion per se. It's a law trying to prevent the eugenic elimination of a group of citizens within the state of Indiana, those who have trisomy 21 or Down syndrome. So Judge Easterbrook went on to say, there is a difference between I don't want a child and I want a child and I want a child, but only male, or I only want a child whose genes predict success in life. So this law would prohibit abortions for sex selection. You know, you don't want a female child, Down syndrome, for race. You know, if you have a one night stand with someone of another race and you are embarrassed by that fact and don't want to have a child who is biracial, well, that's a racist eugenic outlook that the state has an interest in curtailing. Ramesh Ponnuru, excellent pro-life advocate, by the way, wrote an article in National Review recently, NRO, on National Review Online. And this is what he says about this law. He also mentions the other element of the law, which said that you have to dispose of the remains of an unborn child, the fetal remains. You couldn't treat them like medical waste. You have to provide them with burial. You can't just throw them in a dumpster or incinerate them. You have to treat them as human remains. And so this is what Ponnuru says in his write-up on this situation. First, he mentions Casey versus Planned Parenthood. This is important to know that Casey versus Planned Parenthood said the state cannot set up an unreasonable restriction. It can't put an undue burden on a woman who is seeking to have an abortion. That's the Casey standard. So Ponnuru says, it is even less clear that Casey stands in the way of the fetal remains law. It was struck down on two grounds. First, the statute treats fetal remains as though they are corpses of persons. The Supreme Court has said unborn children are not persons. So people are saying you can't have this law for these particular reasons, that you can't treat unborn children like persons. The law says so. And it would put an undue burden on a woman's right to have an abortion if you had to dispose of the remains of an unborn children in a particular way, dispose of fetal remains not as medical waste. So the law in Indiana wanted to make sure the children who are killed by abortion at least have a properly disposed, not treated like medical waste, and tries to ban abortions in the case of choosing it for Down syndrome, race, sex, eugenic purposes. So Ponnuru references back Judge Easterbrook, that circuit judge from the LA Times article, quotes Judge Easterbrook, and his opposition to the law, saying the Supreme Court should take this up. He says his colleagues, he wrote, have held invalid, this is about the fetal remains, burying the child's remains, that part of the statute. He says, they have held invalid a statute that would be sustained if it concerned the remains of cats or gerbils. Just so, Ponnuru says. Upholding the law does not require finding unborn children to be legal persons. The second rationale is implausible. And in fact, a Minnesota law similar to Indiana's was upheld in 1990, that being the undue burden standard. So requiring an abortion provider to not treat children like medical waste, how could that put an undue burden on a woman or to choose an abortion? It doesn't create any kind of quote-unquote obstacle from her doing that. So he goes on to say, just put this here, but abortion is often an exception to the normal rules of our jurisprudence. A few weeks ago, the Supreme Court declined to hear a case involving Medicaid payments to abortion providers, prompting three conservative justices to note an explicit rebuke of their colleagues. I think that was Gorsuch, Thomas, and I forget the other conservative justice. It wasn't, I don't think it was, it wasn't Kavanaugh. It was Gorsuch, I think Alito, and Thomas objected. They wanted to hear the case about funding, states being compelled to, funding Planned Parenthood or withdrawing funds from Planned Parenthood. The Supreme Court refused to hear that case. And so the three conservative justices who did want to hear the case, they said, when there is any tenuous connection to a politically fraught issue, that does not justify abdicating our judicial duties. So that's why Ponnuru's article in the National Review the byline is, do your job, comma, justices. Do your job. Don't refuse to hear a case that is important, that deals with important constitutional issues, just because you know that it involves a political hot potato. So definitely go and check that out on, excuse me, I'm getting over a cold. The cold struck at the absolute worst time. I think I'll talk about it more. I think I'm Free For All Friday. But we arrived in Phoenix to see my family for Christmas, and I noticed the little nasal drip coming out of Thomas's nose ever so slightly and realized, oh no. And so it begins. And, you know, I've just managed to get over that barely before I went out to seek to speak here on January 3rd. I mean, I hadn't gotten sick in weeks. And I think we were as busy, we were traveling, and I didn't get to do my placebo regimen. Whenever I think I'm about to get sick, I'm on the cusp of sickness, I drink an entire half gallon of orange juice. I just chug orange juice. Maybe the vitamin C keeps me well. I don't know. It probably is a placebo effect, but I don't care because it does. It usually works for me, but this time it did not. So talking about this Indiana law and laws that prevent abortion in the case of Down syndrome, and some people will say, well, why would you want to try to pass these laws when they could only save a tiny, tiny fraction of unborn children? Well, first, one life saved is better than no lives saved. Every life is intrinsically valuable, made in the image and likeness of God. Even being able to save one child's life, that is worth it. It's worth it to do that. But also what helps is that when you pass these incremental laws and you get people seeing that some unborn children have value, you start to chip away at their value system to see, wait, why don't we just give value and rights to all these other unborn children? So it has that practical benefit to be able to do that. What I want to talk about here is that these laws, like trying to restrict abortion in case of, you know, choosing it for the child's sex, their race, especially for something like Down syndrome, most people, you know, push comes to shove. On the one hand, they're very sympathetic to what it takes to raise a child with special needs. I don't like the phrase special needs child. That defines a child by their special needs. Rather, it's, you know, a child with special needs. You know, they understand the difficulty there. But I would love just to ask people, and love to do this as a video, to ask them, do you support abortion if a woman has a diagnosis of Down syndrome for her child? A lot of people won't support in that reason, but some will. Then I want to ask them again and bring out a friend who has Down syndrome to ask them that very question and just watch them squirm. I mean, it would just feel so offensive, right? Especially in the presence of someone with Down syndrome to say, yeah, I think abortion's okay in the case of Down syndrome. Well, why? Why? This even for those people who are on the idea that they think, well, disabilities are so hard, and you know, they'll bring up these very, very difficult disabilities to live with. Down syndrome is a moderate disability. It is a disability, but people with Down syndrome can lead functioning, independent lives. That doesn't mean people who need help are less valuable. But I would just love to ask them this question in these other people's presence. And it allows us to bring up an argument. This allows us to bring up an argument against abortion that I call the argument from ableism. So how does that work? Well, what is ableism? It's a kind of discrimination. The Center for Disability Rights defines it this way. It says, ableism is a set of beliefs or practices that devalue and discriminate against people with physical, intellectual, or psychiatric disabilities, and often rests on the assumption that disabled people need to be fixed in one form or the other. So it's the idea here, the reason we have handicapped license plates, that we have wheelchair ramps, that we don't say, even saying things like, that's crazy. For some people say that's ableism, that you are picking on or marginalizing a group of people who need our help to be able to participate equally in society, that we should accommodate disabilities, not use it as a reason to discriminate against people because they have those disabilities. We especially should not say, oh, because you're disabled. The worst form of ableism is to say, because you can't do what I can do, you're less human than I am. That's the worst form of ableism. Oh, because we used to say in the past, 1922 in Buck versus Bell, the Supreme Court said that if you are mentally handicapped, you don't have the right to procreate like anybody else. You're less human than the rest of us. And now we see that's a horrible thing to say. The CDR goes on to say, ableism is intertwined in our culture. Due to many limiting beliefs about what disability does or does not mean, how able-bodied people learn to treat people with disabilities, and how we are often not included at the table for key decisions. So what we can say here is that, look, on the one hand, we would never say to born people, we would never say to them, you don't count or you can't do what we can do, so we're not going to help you, or we're going to say it's legal to kill you because you don't function as well as the rest of us. But with unborn people, we do that all the time. People say, oh, well, an unborn child's not a person because they can't think like us. Or especially this, they can't survive outside of the womb, or they can't survive on their own. So they're not a person because they can't survive on their own. What about somebody who is a quadriplegic? What about somebody who requires others to feed them because they're disabled or they're injured? Are they not a person because they cannot survive on their own? That's ableism. That's saying that your humanity comes from your functional ability, not from your personal identity, your identity as a human being. So if you hear this, these news articles come up about laws to restrict abortion in the case of choosing it because a child has Down syndrome, you can bring up this ableist connection. And I think that it's a pretty good argument to show what's wrong with abortion in general, that it's kind of a giant ableist discrimination against the unborn who need us to live. And that is not a reason to end their lives. It's a reason to help them continue to live out their lives. I want to go on next to talk about another article that I saw for news development here in Arizona. This is from Think Progress, which is a fairly liberal website, news website. And it says, Arizona is officially questioning people who have abortions about their decision. Dun, dun, dun. Doctors have to probe abortion seekers, but they aren't required to answer. So someone with the bylines and the sublines really wanted to make this as insidious as possible to probe abortion seekers. Well, I mean, if they're going to have an abortion, there's going to be some kind of internal exam anyway of some kind to be able to have an abortion. That's going to happen one way or the other. Here, what they're just doing, what the state of Arizona wants to do, is to collect statistics about abortion to understand what is happening, why is it happening. And when the state has more knowledge about abortion, it can do something to reduce this killing of unborn human beings. This is the article by Amanda Michelle Gomez says, patients living in Arizona and seeking to terminate a pregnancy are now being probed about their decision. Okay. Is the abortion elective or for health concerns? Was the pregnancy a result of rape or incest? Abortion seekers will also be asked about whether they're being coerced, if they are a victim of sex trafficking, or if they are domestic violence survivors. Providers are required to ask patients about all this after a new law expanding on existing statutes went into effect on Tuesday. The law, however, doesn't require patients to answer these questions in order to have the procedure. Now, first, I don't see what's controversial about this, that if you go to the research organization affiliated with Planned Parenthood, that's the Alan Guttmacher Institute, they're always publishing survey and data saying why women choose to have abortions. And they use that data in their own propaganda efforts. And of course, how do they acquire that data? Well, their abortion providers, I'm sure, ask women, they do intake forms, and they find out, why are you choosing to have an abortion? And to make sure those statistics are reliable, you would think you'd have to ask women or find them out and just ask. You couldn't just rely on the people who choose to voluntarily self-report, because that might skew the reasons. Like, women who are victims of sexual assault or sex trafficking may be less likely to voluntarily report, and so you have to ask them to report to make sure that you have accurate numbers. So Planned Parenthood does this all the time, relies on this research. Yet when it's being done with the aim of trying to reduce abortion, suddenly there's a pall that's kind of cast over it to make it suspicious. But as Think Progress's Elham Khatami reported in April, the policy amounts to shaming people for deciding to have an abortion. Policies that aim to shame don't work. Don't work for what? What do you mean they don't work? For example, the article goes on to say, the anti-abortion movement got 9 states, including Arizona, to implement laws requiring abortion providers to offer patients the opportunity to view the ultrasound, thinking doing so could influence the patient's decisions. A recent study published by the Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology found ultrasounds didn't dissuade the overwhelming majority of pregnant people from having abortions. Planned Parenthood of Arizona called the new law unnecessary. I love this part. Called the new law unnecessary because the provider already has sensitivity training, particularly for sexual assault survivors or victims of sex trafficking. Telling the Arizona Capital Times, our providers, if they have any suspicion whatsoever about sexual assault, provide information and referral to folks. Ha, 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 ha. I refer you to the live action investigative reports showing where Planned Parenthood employees did not ask or were involved in covering up and not reporting instances where minors, people who come in portraying themselves as minors, saying they're involved in a statutory rape relationship, where Planned Parenthood is involved in covering that up, in covering these things up. So I say, sorry on that one. But what about the claim about ultrasounds, that they don't actually change people's minds? I went and took a look at the surveys. The 2014 one is called Relationship Between Ultrasound Viewing and Proceeding to Abortion. And it concludes, this is a survey of about a study involving 15,000 women who were offered ultrasounds, who viewed them in abortion facilities. I think it was in California. It said, voluntarily viewing the ultrasound image may contribute to a small proportion of women with medium or low decision certainty deciding to continue the pregnancy. Such viewing does not alter decisions of the large majority of women who are certain that abortion is the right choice. I think it was 95% in this case continued to have an abortion. A similar result was found in a plus one study called Evaluating the Impact of a Mandatory Pre-Abortion Ultrasound Viewing Law. This is in plus one in 2017. It's Upadhyaya et al. Is they're the authors. And it concluded this law, it was in Wisconsin, I think, the law requiring looking at an ultrasound before you have an abortion. It said this law caused an increase in viewing rates and a statistically significant, viewing the ultrasound, and a statistically significant but small increase in continuing pregnancy rates. So some people will say, well, you know, why do you even bother doing these laws? They don't work. Well, they don't turn everybody around, but if they at least save some lives, they're worthwhile. And women should review this information anyways, because it's very important. There are some things in medical procedures you may not want to hear about. It may be disturbing or scary, but it's important for you to know about because you may change your mind based on it. That's a principle of informed consent. Informed consent is not based on the idea. It's not based on the idea that, oh, well, we're only going to tell the patient what they want to hear, or the doctor is only going to say what they feel like saying. It's about telling the patient the relevant information for a procedure, and the most relevant information are those pieces where the patient would reasonably choose to abandon the procedure, not undergo it, if they had known that that was a risk, a side effect, or an outcome. So if you go to CareNet, though, CareNet is one of the largest pregnancy resource center providers in the country. This is what they say about this study. They say, in this study, 4.8% of the low and medium decision certainty women, so one out of 20 women who weren't sure if they were going to have an abortion or not, who chose to have an ultrasound changed their minds and did not abort, as opposed to only 1.3% of those who did not see their baby on an ultrasound. So of the women who are likely to change their mind, three times as many chose to not have an abortion when they saw an ultrasound. It was a small minority overall, but still three times as many chose to not have an abortion when they saw their unborn child, of the people who were already kind of ambivalent towards the procedure. The article goes on to say, imagine the pressure to go through with the procedure that all of these women must have felt, and the tremendous courage it must have taken to say no and walk away. What's important, it goes on to say, had these women first visited a pregnancy center, would they have even scheduled an abortion? So when people bring up these statistics to say that ultrasounds don't work, they don't change people's minds, you have to remember, especially in the 2014 case and the 2017 study I mentioned, these are all survey data that come from abortion facilities. Once someone goes to an abortion facility, parks their car, goes inside, signs a form, is talking to the abortion provider, so a lot of them may feel like they really can't back out at this point. They're already committed. They're already here. I might as well do this. They're already very committed. They're here in the abortion facility itself. They're not sure if they want to go back out. They'd rather just have this all over with. So it's not surprising that women who already are on the table at an abortion facility will go through with the procedure. But this shows that when those women, even in an abortion facility, see an ultrasound, they can change their minds, especially if they're already ambivalent. And they're more likely to do that if they see their unborn child. Now, for most cases where you see women most often change their mind, though, is when they're at a pregnancy resource center. Because here they have someone who's positive, who's affirming, who helps them see there are other options. There is a light at the end of the tunnel, that there is a way out of what might seem to be a hopeless situation, to give them these different options and to be able to speak of the baby in positive terms, to describe the baby in a joyful way, to help this woman have joy in this unintended pregnancy rather than heartache and sorrow, which you're not going to find in an abortion facility. So if that comes up, I do recommend you share that rebuttal with people who say ultrasounds don't work, because they do. In fact, even just praying in front of an abortion facility, even your presence there I have heard people say that they were driving to an abortion facility, thought about going, saw people outside praying, and they just turned around. So you never know what your actions will do to be able to help other people. And I'm grateful for your actions that help this podcast. Thank you guys for listening. Please pray for our continued growth. And I hope that you have a blessed day.
If you liked today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.